Welcome to the Shiur Ramban Parshas Toldos. Wanted to start this evening by doing one of the longer Rambans that's towards the beginning of the Sedra. The Ramban in this particular case is reacting to comments from the Ibn Ezra. When we were going through Ibn Ezra a few years back, we actually saw this Ibn Ezra, so hopefully this is at least a little bit of Chazara review. And even in the unlikely case that you don't remember the Ibn Ezra from a couple of years ago, so the Ramban does us the favor of first quoting the Ibn Ezra so he can just refresh our memory, and then he discusses further. The points that Ibn Ezra makes and the response of the Ramban touch on a number of different points in the stories, the multiple stories that are told about Yaakov and Esav and Yitzchak Avinu in Parshas Toldos, so it's sort of a broad picture that he paints. So on Pasuk Lamed Dalid, Perek Chafei, Pasuk Lamed Dalid, Vayivez Esav Esabuchora, Esav after selling the birthright, despised the birthright. So after giving a few very localized remarks, the Ramban writes as follows. Rabbi Avram Mishtabish Bekan Me'od. Rabbi Avram, the Ibn Ezra, really messed up when he came to this interpretation of these psukim. Sha'amar, because the Ibn Ezra writes over here, Ki biza ha-bechora. Why did Esav despise the bechora? What does that mean? That he rejected the bechora, the birthright, in such a fashion? Bavur Shirosh, ein mamon la'aviv. Ibn Ezra says, Esav saw that his father, Yitzchak Avinu, was poor. He had no money. So what does it mean to, you know, what's the birthright all about? The birthright, in the end of the day, is about getting a double portion. As the mathematicians among us know, 2 times 0 is still 0. You know, he didn't have a lot of money, Yitzchak Avinu. So, you know, so Esav says, so, thanks so much. I've got a double portion. I've got a birthright of my father's assets. Thanks so much. That in 275 will get me on the subway. And by the way,
his grandfather's money.
What's that?
What happened to his grandfather?
Oh, okay. Good. The Rabbim Yismahu, many, including some here in the room, asked the following question: how could it be that Yitzchak was poor? Ki azav lo Avram mamon rav. Avram Avinu was wealthy. I mean, that's the psukim say. So Avram Avinu left a sizable inheritance to Yitzchak Avinu. I don't understand these people, says the Ibn Ezra. What? You never saw somebody lose money? You never saw somebody who had a lot of money when he was younger and then lost the money when he was older? You never saw such a thing? V'ho'ed, how do we know that Yitzchak was poor, says the Ibn Ezra? I'll tell you. Shehayu Yitzchak ohev et Esav bavur tzeido. Why did Yitzchak love Esav so much? The Pasuk says, because he brought him food. So what does it mean that Yitzchak loved Esav because he brought him food? If Yitzchak was this incredible, you know, CEO of multiple companies, and, you know, Esav says, you know, Dad, I'll bring you a steak, you know, that wouldn't have swayed Yitzchak in any sizable way. Why was Yitzchak so swayed by the steak that Esav brought him? Because that was mamish, like, wow, I haven't eaten in days. You know, we have nothing at home. And that's why, says the Ibn Ezra, Esav was so anxious to sell his bechora, his birthright, for a bowl of porridge, a bowl of lentil stew, because apparently in the house of Yitzchak Avinu, says the Ibn Ezra, having a good soup was a precious commodity. It wasn't a little thing to trifle with. If Yitzchak Avinu every day had a beautiful, lovely supper, so why was he so anxious for Esav to bring him some food? Bring me a good steak. What do you mean? I just snap my fingers and the servants bring me a good steak. You know, obviously, you know, there wasn't so much plenty in the house of Yitzchak Avinu. Another question. It says that when Yaakov went to take the bracha to deceive his mother, his father, into thinking that he was in fact Esav, so he went to Esav's closet and he took out big day Esav HaChamudos, the very fancy clothing. The Chamudos means beloved, the beloved fancy clothing that Esav had to dress up as Esav. So how come Yaakov didn't have fancy clothing? Well, so apparently the only one in the house who had a tuxedo was Esav. Yaakov didn't have a tuxedo. He had a polo shirt. You know, that was it. You know, a white polo shirt, maybe. But you know, he didn't have the kind of fancy clothes that Esav had. Another question. So that's a midrashic interpretation. I say, but you know, the Ibn Ezra is a Pashtun. You know, he was a straightforward, simple meaning of the text person. Furthermore, v'lo naslo imo kesef izavlo derech. If they were so rich, says the Ibn Ezra, how is it that Rivka sends Yaakov away, run away, and she doesn't pack him any money? Right? I mean, when Yaakov comes on his way running in next week's parasha, when he's running away from Eretz Yisrael, he davens to Hashem, v'nasan li lechem lechel uveged l'lbosh, Ribbono Shel Olam, please give me food to eat and clothing to wear. What do you mean? You're coming from a wealthy household. You know, she didn't give you gold and silver when you ran out to be able to buy everything. I understand. You couldn't take your whole wardrobe with you. You're a fugitive. But give the man a credit card, you know, that he should be able to, you know, a couple of traveler's checks, maybe, you know, gold, silver, something that he can take with him on the way. How come she didn't give him money? Aye, but we find in the beginning of the parasha that Yitzchak Avinu apparently did have a lot of money. The whole story about how he interacts with the Plishtim, and it says Vayigdal Ho'ish, the man Yitzchak became very great in a monetary sense. So says the Ibn Ezra, Kodem Ziknoso. That was early on, right? Early on, Yitzchak Avinu had a lot of wealth, but apparently the stock market went down. He lost all the wealth.
If we
want to
disregard Rashi,
we could
do anything.
But
Rashi,
if David has to disregard Rashi left and right, not Akasha.
She says that he asked the two sheep because she was entitled to two a day from her.
Again, that. The Ibn Ezra doesn't feel bound to midrashic interpretations.
I don't know. And also, Rashi also says that he went to yeshiva, so that he didn't need money.
All right. Again, the Ibn Ezra is dealing with the pshat, the simple interpretation of the pesukim. That's how the Ibn Ezra operates. And so he said, and then he adds the following: the ivrei leiv. People who are blind in their hearts think that if you're a tzaddik, you have to be wealthy. And the example of Yitzchak Avinu says that Ibn Ezra should show us the opposite, that you could be poor, as Yitzchak Avinu was, and still be a very big tzaddik, a very big righteous person. Right? In other words, don't think that material wealth and righteousness necessarily have to go hand in hand. Now, this is just a very important autobiographical statement by the Ibn Ezra, because the Ibn Ezra, for most of his life, didn't have two cents to rub together. The Ibn Ezra himself was an incredibly, incredibly poor individual, and somebody who, from a material perspective, was not particularly lucky in life. The Ibn Ezra, at one point in his life, said about himself that he had no mazel, he had no luck. He said, you know, whatever I go into, it doesn't work out for me. If I would become a maker of shrouds, people would stop dying. If I would become a candle maker, the sun would never set. As he said about himself, I don't have any luck with any profession that I go into, says the Ibn Ezra. And he wandered from place to place. I mean, the Ibn Ezra, you know, talks about having, you know, the Ibn Ezra is from Spain. In one of his commentaries, he mentions sort of, by the way, about what people do in India, you know, which gives the impression that he ended up in India at some point, which, again, in the Middle Ages, to go from Spain to India
you know, it was a pretty pretty unusual sort of thing. He didn't just hop on a flight, especially because he had no money, but he didn't just hop on a flight and just go from Spain to India. So when the Ibn Ezra says, you know, you should recognize that a lot of the backdrop for all of these stories with Yitzchak and Yaakov and Esav is the fact that Yitzchak is poor, and that's why Esav is anxious to get a good bowl of soup for supper, and that's why Yitzchak is anxious to get a steak, and that's, you know, sort of the backdrop for all these stories. The Ibn Ezra read the psukim that way, but the Ibn Ezra is probably also in the back of his mind thinking, you know, I guess it's a little bit of a comfort. If Yitzchak Avinu was poor, it doesn't bother me so much that I'm poor also. I'm walking in the footsteps of Yitzchak Avinu. So that's the Ibn Ezra. Writes the Ramban, V'ani tomei, mi iver eino sichlo bozeh. The Ibn Ezra refers to people who don't get this. You know, people who think that it's a contradiction to be poor and to be righteous. He says that their mind's eye is blind. The Ramban writes back, and he says, I don't know who blinded the mind of the Ibn Ezra to think such a thing, that Yitzchak Avinu was poor. You know, by the Rishonim, they didn't mince words. You know, they said it like it was. Right? Why is the Ibn Ezra so wrong? Kinei Avram hiniach lo hon rav. Right? Avram Avinu left a tremendous fortune, you know, to Yitzchak Avinu. According to Ibn Ezra, you have to say that Yitzchak Avinu lost all of that money right before the episode in the beginning of the parasha, right? In other words, in the beginning of the parasha, Yaakov and Esav are teenagers, right? They're teenagers. Avram Avinu, again, according to Chazal, has just passed away at that point. So you have to say that early on in the Sedra, Yitzchak Avinu had lost all the money from Avram Avinu. And then, Achar Kein Chazar V'Hesher V'Eretz Plishtim. But then in the next chapter, in Chavav, we find that Yitzchak goes to the land of the Plishtim, and it says there explicitly that he became very rich. So in other words, he went from being very rich, to being very poor, to being very rich, and then, in Perek of Zion, the last Perek in the Sedra, where it talks about Yaakov Avinu getting the bracha through stealth. So the premise of the Ibn Ezra is that Yitzchak Avinu was poor during that episode. So you have to say that he lost all of his wealth a second time. He lost all the wealth he got from Avram Avinu. He then regained it. He lost all of that wealth again, and he became poor. And you know, you end up depicting the financial health of Yitzchak Avinu as being sort of like a, you know, like a roller coaster. You know, he was rich, he was poor, he was rich, he was poor. You know, like, and says the Ramban, the aim elu rak divrei tzchok. That's a joke. It's a joke to say that that Yitzchak Avinu's, you know, financial status is just sort of swinging back and forth. You know, one episode in his life, he's rich, then he's poor, then he's rich, then he's poor. It's a joke to say like that, you know, to make such a statement, you know. The old, furthermore, the Pasuk says at the end of Parshas Chayisara, Vahi acharei mos Avram, when Avram Avinu passed away, Vayivarech Elokim es Yitzchak beno. Hashem blessed Yitzchak. The meaning of a bracha in this context, says the Ibn Ezra, says the Ramban, is clearly that there should be financial security. You know, for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to directly bless a tzaddik means at least part of, maybe not the whole bracha, but at least part of that bracha is that the person should have financial security. Because if you don't have financial security, you don't get off the ground. You know, you could be blessed with so many other things in life, but if you can't support yourself, you don't, you know, you're so poor. We're not talking about, you know, wealth. If you're so poor that, you know, you're going to make decisions as to who your favorite son is based on the stake that they bring you, you know, so that's not a life. You know, a bracha from HaKadosh Baruch Hu is to have financial security. I, says the Ramban, there are tzaddikim who are poor. That's true. Certainly true. There's no question that that's true. But, to, you know, those tzaddikim didn't get a bracha directly from the mouth, kiviyachol, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If God gives you a bracha, which God gave Yitzchak Avinu a bracha, so the intent of, part of that bracha means that Yitzchak Avinu is going to be blessed with financial security. The truth is, says the Ramban, Hayu ha'avos kulam kimalachim. You should know that all three avos, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, were like kings. They were recognized as kings by the people around them. They had the wealth and the prestige associated with kings. And by the way, says the Ramban, v'mahayo Yitzchak ra hamazel ma'abe nichsei aviv. According to the Ibn Ezra's interpretation, Yitzchak Avinu was the shlamazel of the greatest order. I mean, he starts off rich, he loses the money. Right? He starts off rich with inherited money, right? He didn't even earn the money. He inherits the money of his father, and then somehow he loses it. And then he gains it back again, and then he loses it again. You don't have a bigger shlamazel than that. If Yitzchak Avinu was such a big shlamazel, says the Ramban, so how could the Plishtim say to him as they do, Ra'o ro'inu ki hoyo Hashem imach. We see that God is with you. Yeah, we see that God is with you. This guy inherits a huge fortune, and all of a sudden, it's all gone? I don't know. You know, I wouldn't cast my lot with that guy from a financial perspective. When the Plishtim say, we see that God is with you, they're not talking about the fact that he was a big tillim sayer, or that, you know, he said incredible shiurim. They meant in a very materialistic sense. We see that God is with you. We see that God provides for you. Yeah, God provides for you, but you lost all your father's wealth. It doesn't fit in together, says the Ramban. Then the Ramban adds a couple of interesting points to round out his perspective that, you know, it's utterly wrong to suggest that Yitzchak Avinu was poor, and certainly is utterly wrong to suggest that Yitzchak Avinu's poverty is somehow the driving factor behind so many of the stories that we see in Parshas Toldos. So let's go back to one issue that we touched on before. The Ibn Ezra had said that what motivated Esav to despise the Bukhara was very simply, he said, I'm not going to get any money out of it. What's the Bukhara? What's the birthright? Getting a double portion. A double portion of nothing is nothing. You know? So what? You know, Yaakov will get one carrot and I'll get two carrots. You know, that's not so exciting, right? So that's why he rejected the birthright. Says the Ramban, besides all the other questions I have on the Ibn Ezra, Yitachen kipi ashrayim bebuchara b'mishpatei haTorah lohaya kein lifnim. It's not necessarily the case that prior to the giving of the Torah, a Bukhar, a firstborn, necessarily got a double portion. This is all, you know, the assumption that being the firstborn was primarily about material rights, you know, is an assumption. That's based on the way the Torah creates it after the Torah was given. This is pre the giving of the Torah. Who says that being a Bukhar necessarily meant that you get a double portion? Maybe it's Raklin Chol Milas Aviv Usvaruso. Maybe it's just a question of the leadership. In other words, Avram Avinu was the leader of this clan that would eventually become the Jewish people. Who's going to be the leader of the clan after Yitzchak? You know, so that's what the birthright is about. It's not necessarily a financial issue. It could be that it's a leadership issue. And to be honest, you know, who's going to be the next leader is something that's of value whether the people in question are rich or poor. I mean, obviously it has somewhat more value if, you know, if you're rich. In other words, to be the leader of a rich clan is more significant than being the leader of a poor clan. But even being the leader of a poor clan of people, who's going to be the leader? Even if we're a bunch of, you know, 10-year-old kids and, you know, we're playing in the sandbox, figuring out who's the leader, you know, is a significant thing. And then he says as follows, L'chein ha'ya omer li'yitzchak, Ani bincha b'chorecha. When Yaakov Avinu comes into Yitzchak by the brachos, and he says, I am your son, your firstborn, it's not necessarily the case that that's a lie. Now, in biological terms, Esav was born first, that's true, but maybe b'chor is that, you know, not necessarily a function of who was born first. but just the title. And indeed, Yaakov Avinu bought the title of being Bechor from Esav at the beginning of the Sedra. So when he comes into Yaakov Avinu and he says, I'm the Bechor, right? So I'm the firstborn. So he's not making a statement about biology, he's making a statement about position. And he did indeed purchase the position. Now it's interesting the way the Ramban presents it. The Ramban paraphrases the Pasuk, but he does so in a way which takes the biggest sting out of the Pasuk, because when Yaakov Avinu goes to Yitzchak and he says, I'm the Bechor, he doesn't say, as the Ramban quotes him, Ani bincha Bechorecha, right? I am your son, your firstborn. He says, Ani Esav Bechorecha, I'm Esav, your firstborn. And that's really the question that people have. You know, I mean, you can say that you buy the right of being the Bechor. It's hard to say that I bought the right to be Esav. So the Ramban doesn't address this directly, but I think what's implicit in his words is that it doesn't really matter. In other words, once we understand the word Bechor to mean a title and a position, and not necessarily a statement of reality or biology, right? So the term Esav also doesn't mean my name is Esav, you know, check my ID, my name is Esav, but it means for all intents and purposes, I am Esav. In other words, I bought, you know, what Esav had, i.e. the Bechorah, the birthright, I bought that off of him. So for all intents and purposes, I am Esav. You know, I'm not actually Esav, but I have all of the qualifications of Esav, as far as you're concerned, for the granting of the bracha, because I bought that, in a sense, I bought Esav's identity by virtue of purchasing the Bechorah off of him. Again, the Ramban doesn't quite say this, but I think it's somewhat implicit in the statements of the Ramban.
But he said he was the first one in, the last one.
Right, so that's the Vilna Gaon, you know, famously said that, you know, it's kind of like when you put marbles, you know, into a chute, right? Like, first one in, last one out. But the Ramban isn't even addressing that. You know, the Ramban, I think, is just very simply stating that, you know, when he purchased the birthright from Esav, he purchased the right to call himself the firstborn, and he even, again, this, the Ramban doesn't quite say, but I think he is implicit, he even purchased the right to refer to himself as Esav. In other words, because he bought that identity for all intents and purposes. Now, another point that the Ramban brings out, Hatzayid asher hayo b'fiv, the fact that Esav was supposed to bring Yitzchak a steak in order to get the bracha. So the Ibn Ezra says, well, that's the sign that Yitzchak Avinu had no money. You know, he was hankering for a steak. You know, I'm starving. I haven't eaten in days. You know, bring me something. Says the Ramban, not necessarily. Ken yasu hasarim v'hamelochim bocherim b'tzayid mikol machol v'chol ho'amim yovilu mehem shay lamora. The fact that Esav brought food to his father doesn't necessarily mean that his father didn't have food. But that was something, that was the kind of approach that one would use in dealing with a king or a very exalted person. You know that the king likes a particular type of food, so as a sign of friendship and respect, you bring him a sample of that food. Right? Some people here probably remember the Reagan White House and the jelly beans. So if one were to visit President Reagan and bring him, you know, jelly beans as a present, you know, the implication would not be, you know, President, you look like you haven't eaten in days, you know, you could probably really use some jelly bellies in order to give you a little pick-me-up. No, but this would be a sign of friendship and respect. You know that the President happens to like a particular food, so you bring him a sample in order to show, you know, to build that relationship. So, you know, Esav, as a sign of reverence and respect for his father, brings him this food. Not that he needed the food, not that he was hungry, but it's a way of demonstrating the reverence that he has for his father. More than that, umasha omar levarich oso achara soslo hamat amim. Yeah.
If we can talk about the shot, you know, the chumash says explicitly that Yitzchak thought Cody was God, and that's why he wanted
his Esav. What?
Huh?
that Yitzchak thought he was dying, and that's why he gave on to the brachos, right? To be fair, he doesn't say he thinks he's dying. Lo yodati yom mosi. I don't know when I'm going to die.
No, Rashi, they present this that it was his last dinner. No.
The pasuk doesn't say that. He says lo yodati yom mosi. I don't know when I'm going to die, right? But not that. Not that I'm about to. There's a huge difference between I don't know what I'm going to die versus I'm about to die, right? In other words, he's not saying I'm about to die and therefore, give me the Last Supper and then, maybe a cigarette after the meal. What?
Because he says that he exceeded his mother's
life. He feels that he's getting close to that stage in life. But again, there's a huge difference between saying I'm an old man, I don't know when I'm going to go, versus I feel I'm going to go imminently. There's a huge difference between those two things. But comes the Ramban and says, what's the role of the food? Again, so one role of the food is the reverence that Esav displays for his father. But it goes deeper than that, says the Ramban. Why does Yitzchak Avinu say, bring me the food and I'll bless you? So Ibn Ezra says, because I'm hungry, I'll give you the bracha because you'll do something good for me. Says the Ramban, no, that's far too more simplistic. Rasa lehenos mimenu, shetiyo nasho kshura b'nasho be'etza hana'a. Yitzchak Avinu wanted to have pleasure from Esav, and that would create a feeling, a bond of love between the two of them. Again, obviously he loved him already. It says so in the pasuk of Yitzchak. But you have Yitzchak as Esav. But Yitzchak wanted to feel a overwhelming sense of love in the moment. How do you create a sense of love vis-a-vis someone else? You benefit from them. The most direct and simple way to benefit from someone else is that they bring you good food. Again, there are a lot of other ways you can benefit from people, but if you bring me this good food, it will make me feel well disposed towards you, Yitzchak says to Esav, and that's the kind of mood I want to create in order to be able to bestow the bracha. Yivarech oso b'chefetz mole v'ratzon shalem. Apparently, again, I don't know how brachas work, but apparently you see from this Ramban that if you want to bestow a bracha upon somebody else in the most effective manner, you should bring yourself to the point where you feel an overwhelming sense of love for the other person. If I give you a bracha and I don't particularly like you, if my bracha is kind of like a throwaway thing, like, good things by you also, right? The famous line, we bless the Tsar and we hope that he stays far away, right? So, if it's that kind of bracha, I'll give you a bracha, whatever. That bracha is not so effective. The best kind of bracha is a bracha that's accompanied with a tremendous sense of love for the recipient of the bracha. So how do you generate that sense of love for the recipient of the bracha? So Yitzchak Avinu says, it's simple. Feed me food. Do something good for me. And I will naturally feel a tremendous love for you, and that will express itself in the bracha. It's along the lines that when the Kohanim bless the people, the very bracha itself is Asher kitcharu b'mitzvoso v'tzivanu b'kdushaso shel Aaron v'tzivanu levarech es amo Yisrael be'ava. The mandate that the Kohanim have is to bless the people with ahava, with love. So, and that apparently is because the bracha is more effective when it's done with love. So that's the role of the food.
Maybe that's why you give money forever.
Right, 100%. I think that's part of it. If I feel that you're helping me out, you're giving me hana, just on a natural level, I will extend the bracha in with more of a lev shalem, more of a full heart. A somewhat different, but mostly similar pshat, says the Ramban. Shahaya yodeya benafsho ki achar ho achila hoisa misaneges v'simcha v'smecha v'yachula le'ruach hakodesh. There's a concept that a person can merit ruach hakodesh davka out of a sense of simcha and enjoyment. And he quotes here a pasuk from Malachim Beis Perek Gimel, where Elisha HaNavi is looking to receive divine prophecy. So Elisha HaNavi calls for his servant and says, could you have somebody, you know, play a nigun on the harp for me? If somebody plays music, I will be moved. And if I'm moved and I'm happy and I'm comfortable, that will enable me to receive Ruach HaKodesh, the Divine Spirit, and to utter prophecy. So, you know, if you get any kind of sensory pleasure, whether it's through music or through good food or something like that, that can be a catalyst to receive Ruach HaKodesh. And Yitzchak Avinu says, I want that catalyst to take place. So that's why I need the food, not because I'm poor, but that will help me achieve the Ruach HaKodesh that I need in order to be able to bestow the bracha.
It doesn't have to become very complicated. If he's looking into the future and telling him you're going to have this good thing and have that good thing, then he's not really giving him a blessing. He's just looking into the future and predicting. In other words, I'm giving you some of the bracha. Why do I need the Ruach HaKodesh for?
No, so the Ruach HaKodesh apparently is important to make the bracha effective. And however this works exactly, the bracha becomes effective because Ruach HaKodesh. In other words, how do brachas work? I don't pretend to know. But it can't just be as simple as, I'll just say some magic words and you'll get it. There has to be some kind of something behind it.
So
what makes the bracha effective apparently is the Ruach HaKodesh. Okay, we'll pick up after Maariv the second part. Welcome to the second half of the Shia and the Ramban Parshas Toldos. So we had seen the first half of the Shia, the words of the Ramban arguing with the Ibn Ezra about the financial security of Yitzchak Avinu, the Ibn Ezra claiming that Yitzchak Avinu was poor, that he had made money, lost money. The Ramban rejects all of that, and in the course of doing that, the Ramban gives alternate explanations about the need for the food that Yitzchak Avinu needed before giving the bracha, he requested before giving the bracha, and the nature of pishnayim, the fact that the double portion for the bechor, for the firstborn, may not have even been in existence prior to Matan Torah. Wanted to see the second half of the shiur, another very essential Ramban, where the Ramban develops an idea which we first saw back in Parshas Lech Lecha, the concept that was referred to later on as Maisa Ovos Simon Labanim, that whatever happens to the Ovos HaKdoshim is ultimately a foreshadowing of what's going to happen to Klal Yisrael in the future.
Because you could sell the anybody could sell the quarter.
I mean, the person who had the Bukhara could sell the Bukhara, right?
Yeah.
That's what comes out. I mean, again, you had to have it to be able to sell it, but if you had it,
somebody
would be able to sell it. That's what you see from the psukim. Yeah. So, in the beginning of Perek Chavav, there's a famine which breaks out in Eretz Yisrael. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to Yitzchak Avinu and he tells him, don't leave Eretz Yisrael, rather you should go to Gror, you should go to the land of the Plishtim, which is still, you know, within the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. Right? Why did Hashem have to tell him this? Right? So writes the Ramban that Hayu Yitzchak Chafes Laleches V'Derech Avosav Leired Shom. Right, Yitzchak Avinu, as we see throughout Parshas Toldos, wanted to try to follow in the footsteps of Avraham Avinu. So if Avraham Avinu had left Eretz Yisrael during a time of famine, so Yitzchak Avinu also thought that it was the right thing to do, not just a convenient thing to do, but the right thing to do, to leave Eretz Yisrael in a time of famine. So why did Hashem tell him not to go? So he writes, again quoting Chazal, which is quoted by Rashi as well, the Ramban writes, Tam Hamaniyo, why did Hashem tell him not to leave Eretz Yisrael? Amru Rabu Seinu, Ata Ola Tmima, Hashem said to Yitzchak Avinu, you are an unblemished offering, a carbon of sorts. Ve'en Chutzal Ha'aretz Kedai Loch. And, you know, for somebody like you, it doesn't make sense to go to Chutzal Ha'aretz. You should just go to the land of the Plishtim. Avraham Avinu had a different, you know, approach in Avodas Hashem. He didn't have the status of being an Ola Tmima, whatever that means exactly. For you, it's not the right thing to leave Eretz Yisrael. Well, the Daiti, Nichnal od be'inyan remisa ba'asid. Beyond just the back and forth of Yitzchak Avinu wanting to follow in the footsteps of Avraham Avinu, there's this whole discussion contains a hint for what's going to be in the future. Kigalas Avraham Mitzrayim Nei Arav Ramaz Shiyiglu Banav Sham. So as the Rambam already said in Parshas Lech Lecha, Avraham Avinu leaving Eretz Yisrael at a time of famine and going to Egypt is very, very clearly a foreshadowing of the fact that just two generations later, Yaakov and his sons are going to leave Eretz Yisrael to go down to Egypt because of a famine, and they're going to run into trouble in Egypt, the same way that Avraham Avinu ran into trouble in Egypt. V'lechto el Avimelech lo hayagolus ki shom hayoshev biratzono. When Avraham Avinu, in contrast, went to the land of Avimelech, that didn't foreshadow a kind of galus, and it wasn't the galus for Avraham Avinu himself, because there, Avimelech basically gave Avraham Avinu free rein within the land and didn't really bother him. Now, again,
grabbing his wife.
Except grabbing his wife, but he didn't realize that he was his wife. So again, you know, not that that really makes it so much better, but, you know, again, from the perspective of Avimelech, who's described by the Psukim as being a basically a good person, a righteous person, you know, grabbing women in general is not a good thing, but from the perspective of Avimelech, you know, he saw Sarah as the woman who was quote-unquote available. Again, there's one madrig of available, like, would you like to go out to dinner? There's another madrig of available, like, you know, what Avimelech did, but again, it is a different scenario than that which is in Mitzrayim. Aval yiridaso shel Yitzchak sham ne'arav yirmos legolus. But in contrast, when Yitzchak goes to the land of the Plishtim and Avimelech, that actually hints to a galus, a future galus, namely, ki galam imakom abal karcho v'holach el eretz acheres, because there was some external factor which pushed Yitzchak Avinu to leave his own land and to go to a different land. What the Rambam seems to be focusing on over here is that when Avram goes to Egypt, he's forced by an external factor, the famine. When Yitzchak goes to the land of the Plishtim, he's forced by an external factor, the famine. When Avram Avinu goes to the land of the Plishtim, he's not forced by anything external. He's just simply traveling, and that's where he chooses to settle. So in other words, Avram Avinu's initial decision to go to the land of the Plishtim is made of his own free will. It's not because there's anything pushing him to go there. Yitzchak goes to the land of the Plishtim because he has to, because it's not working out in Eretz Yisrael at the time because of the famine. So, v'nei haya golusim in mekom el eretz Plishtim shehi eretz megurei aviv. When Yitzchak goes to the land of the Plishtim, because of some external factor, he goes to a land where his father, Avraham Avinu, had previously dwelt. This hints, says the Rambam, to the fact that there will come an episode in Jewish history where the Jewish people will be forced out of Eretz Yisrael and forced to return to a land from whence they came originally. What is that? What is that episode? So says the Rambam, that's Galus Bavel. By Galus Bavel, they're exiled to Babylonia because there was an external factor pushing the Jews out of Eretz Yisrael. The Babylonians conquered Eretz Yisrael, destroyed the Beis Hamikdash, destroyed Yerushalayim, and took the Jews away in chains. Where did they go? To Bavel. Bavel was the very place that Avraham Avinu had spent time in. Again, according to the Ramban at the end of Parashas Noach, Avraham Avinu was not born in Bavel, but he spent significant time there. That's Ur Kasdim. Ur Kasdim is in Bavel. So Yitzchak going to the land of the Plishtim, a land in which his father had dwelled, is significant because it foreshadows the Jewish people going back to a land from which they had come at some point in our history. That's the Galus of Bavel. V'da ki agalus on Yitzchak yirmos l'maisa Yitzchak. Right? There are many other parallels between the Galus of Bavel and what happened to Yitzchak. Kasher lo lokhu ishto velo hayo lo sham rak hagalus vehapachad. Right? Yitzchak's wife Rivka was not taken by Avimelech. Again, if you take a look in the Pesukim, part of our the Pesukim say that Vayishalu Anshe Amakom LeIshto VaYomer Achosihi. Yitzchak described Rivka as his sister, not his wife. But unlike the episodes with Sarah, Rivka is never actually taken by Avimelech. It says that Avimelech looked out the window and he saw Yitzchak and Rivka engaged in an activity that would mark them as husband and wife. And then Avimelech says to Yitzchak and says, wait a minute, I thought you said she was your sister. In other words, it never gets to the point where she's actually abducted. It's just that Yitzchak Avinu is nervous that something is going to happen. So that's already a little bit different than the story with Avram and, you know, the two stories with Avram Avinu. So that is also significant in terms of the Galus Bavel. Why is that? Because the Galus Bavel, Galusham Nezal Afosra of, it was literally a famine that drove the Jews to go to Bavel. The famine was a function of the fact that the city of Yerushalayim was under siege. You know, it wasn't just a famine, you know, without anything else. It was a famine that was brought about by war, but it was a famine. A famine drove the Jews out of Eretz Yisrael. What's that?
Wasn't the siege?
A siege in the first time and the siege in the second time. Once the Jews actually arrived in Bavel, they came. They were probably frightened and terrified. But we don't find that the Babylonians really mistreated the Jews once they came to Bavel. The opposite is true. Ultimately, you know, the Jews rose up the ranks, and you have somebody like a Daniel who becomes basically second in command in the Babylonian Empire, right? So the Jews were not mistreated when they were in Bavel. So that's similar to the fact that when Yitzchak goes to the land of the Plishtim, he's not actually mistreated, at least insofar as his wife is concerned. His wife is not abducted. You know, he's not treated in quite the same way that Sarah Imenu is treated. And what happens while Yitzchak is in the land of the Plishtim? Originally, Avimelech says, this man is under our protection. Anyone who touches this man or his wife is going to die. But ultimately, Avimelech goes to Yitzchak and says, Lech Leimanu, get out of here. You know, you took too much from us. You got to leave. What happens to the Jews in Bavel? So the Persians conquer the Babylonian Empire. And Koresh says, Mi bochem yikol amo yihi elokav imo vayoel. Koresh, Cyrus, basically issues a decree that the Jews are free to go to Eretz Yisrael. Now here the Ramban is making an interesting point, which, again, it's subtle, and I'm not 100% sure he's saying this, but I think this is implicit. When Avimelech tells Yitzchak to go, he doesn't say you have the option of going, he says you must go. I think the way Koresh's declaration is usually understood is that you may go, right? Not that you must go, you may go. But it seems like the Ramban, in drawing a parallel between the two statements, that of Avimelech to Yitzchak and that of Koresh to the Jewish people, is saying that Koresh's declaration was really more you must go rather than you may go. You'll tell me, but many didn't go. All right, you know, I mean, it wouldn't be the first time in history that a ruler issued a declaration or a commandment, and it wasn't universally followed. You know, Koresh perhaps didn't follow up, on his decree, you know, to force the Jews to leave Bavel. But, you know, whether explicitly or maybe implicitly, the Ramban is saying Koresh's intention was not simply, it wasn't simply benevolent, like, you know, oh, you are free to go and resettle Eretz Yisrael, but there was an element of, we'd really like you to leave. You know, maybe it wasn't an absolute obligation, you must leave, but there was certainly, you know, an element in Koresh's declaration, it would be great if all of you left. Not only that, not that you have the right to leave, but, you know, we really would like to encourage you know, your emigration from Bavel, from these lands, you know, to go back to Eretz Yisrael. That would be the parallelism, the way the Ramban presents it. Furthermore, we also find a certain amount of flip-flopping in, you know, the attitude of the Persian Empire towards the Jews, the same way we find that flip-flopping in Avimelech's attitude towards Yitzchak. Initially, Avimelech says Yitzchak and his family should be protected, right? Anything happens to them, you know, anyone molests them, you'll be put to death. Then Avimelech sends Yitzchak away, and the Plishtim get in the way of all of the well digging that Yitzchak Avinu and his people are doing. And then all of a sudden, Avimelech comes back to Yitzchak and says, you know, let's make nice, you know, we made a mistake, let's have shalom between the two of us, you know, you're here, you're there, you're back, you're forth. Consider the attitude of the Persian Empire, which the Ramban, again, over here is conflating with the Babylonians, because they're the successors to the Babylonians. Consider the attitude of the Persian Empire vis-a-vis the Jews of the building of the Beis HaMikdash. You're welcome to go back to Eretz Yisrael. You can build the Beis HaMikdash. In fact, the Psukim and Ezra describe how, you know, the Persians said to the Jews, we'll give you financial support to build the Beis HaMikdash. We'll finance the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Then all of a sudden the Persians withdraw their support, as detailed in the Psukim and Ezra. And then all of a sudden the Persians, after years, you know, decide that now we do support the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and the Jews are able to finish off what they had begun before. Where does this flip-flopping come from? So the Ramban suggests that it's all rooted in the back and forth in Avimelech's interactions with Yitzchak. That's foreshadowing the fact that the Jews are going to be in a galus where, you know, the ruling powers are going to vacillate in terms of their attitude towards the Jewish people.
Is there some kind of a connection between the Christian and the Persians? Or just
Well, the Ramban is saying like this: the Plishtim represent a country where Avraham Avinu had previously lived. So Bavel represents a country where the Jews had previously lived, and you know, Avraham Avinu had lived there. And the Ramban seems to be merging the Babylonians and the Persians, because the Persians took over the Babylonian Empire, and the Jews were still living in that same geographical area. It used to be Bavel, now it's Paras, right? So the Ramban is mixing together Bavel and Paras in terms of, you know, what the Galus is foreshadowed.
Also, another point is this flip-flop is actually a problem to Klal Yisrael at the end of the day, because Ahasuerus was a flip-flop.
Right.
That's
right, it's very, very interesting. Right, Rabbi Rubin wants to suggest that the flip-flopping that we find in the Persian Empire was also manifest in the story of Purim, with Ahasuerus going back and forth. So maybe in a certain sense, they're vacillating, you know, served us well on some level. It's a good point. Yeah.
The Babylonians were the Babylonians. The Persians were better to the Jews than the Babylonians, right?
In some ways. I mean, the point that Ramban is making also is that once the Babylonians exiled the Jews to Bavel, they basically left them alone in Bavel. They didn't really molest them.
He spoke about how they were eternally punished, the land. In other words, even the land today, Iraq, and the suffering of the land itself.
Right.
That, you know, you sort of, I thought got the impression that the Babylonians were as bad as the Romans.
Well, again, they destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, they destroyed Yerushalayim, they threw the Jews out of Eretz Yisrael. Those are all bad things. The Ramban is just saying that, you know, once the Jews actually made it to Bavel, you know, they were not really molested by the Babylonians at that point. So in other words, again, the Ramban is continuing this idea of Maisa Avos Timon Labanim in ways that are less obvious. You know, offhand, when we read the Chumash and we read the story of Yitzchak Avinu going to the land of the Plishtim, we don't automatically think, oh, that has what to do with the Jews going into Galus and Bavel. That wouldn't be the first thing that comes to mind. But once the Ramban shows some of the parallels, you know, and he forces us to think a little bit more deeply about it, we really see, again, this idea of Maisa Avos Timon Labanim, not just on the superficial level. Avram going to Mitzrayim clearly seems to foreshadow the Jews going down to Mitzrayim, but here, even on a deeper level, there's an aspect of Maisa Avos Timon Labanim.
The problem about Yitzchak, I mean, maybe this is not directly related to what the Rav is saying, but maybe myself is, why is it that the Torah speaks so heavily about Avram? So heavily by Yaakov, and completely by Yitzchak. Yeah. The only Maisa that we have about Yitzchak.
Right. So I mean, you see that just being a doing your avodah, connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu without anything particularly exciting is also a derech in avodah Hashem. That's what we see. You don't have to have.
Had kedusha seretz
yisroel. Apparently, yeah. It did have kedusha seretz yisroel, or at least, let's put it this way. Some of the briskers talk about kedusha seretz yisroel versus shame eretz yisroel. You can have parts of eretz yisroel that don't have the full kedusha, but they're deemed as being, eretz yisroel. So the eretz haplishtim, at the very least, had shame eretz yisroel, even if it didn't have kedusha eretz yisroel. Okay, we'll pick up as Hashem next week. Rabbi Chananel ben Akasha, Omer. No, I think we're short. Okay, pick up next week. There's the question.